Hello, ladies and gentlemen. We are now embarking on a study of Hosea, starting with chapter 1, which I will entitle Hosea's Wife and Children. A little introduction from Barnes. Hosea is at the head of the minor prophets. He's the first of the minor prophets. Why are the minor prophets called minor? It's not because their prophecies are less important. It's merely because their books are shorter than the major prophets, like Isaiah and Jeremiah, Ezekiel and Daniel. Now, let me give you a succinct description of the times of Hosea. He prophesied in the 8th century B.C., the 700s B.C. Here's what Albert Barnes says. This was the darkest period in the history of the kingdom of Israel. Jeroboam II was almost the last king who ruled in it by the appointment of God. The rest of Hosea's life was passed amid the decline of the kingdom of Israel. Politically, all was anarchy or misrule. Kings made their way to the throne through the murder of their predecessors and made way for their successors through their own murder, he means. The whole kingdom of Israel was a military despotism. Sad times. We start in verse 1. The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, son of Beeri, during the reigns of Uzziah, 767 to 740, he ruled. Jotham, 740 to 732. Ahaz, 732 to 716. And Hezekiah, 716 to 687, kings of Judah. Now notice, these are the kings of Judah, but Hosea prophesied to the northern kingdom of Israel. That can be a little bit confusing. And of Jeroboam, this is Jeroboam II, the northern king. He ruled from 782 to 753, the son of Jehoash, who ruled from 798 to 782, king of Israel. Now, why were all those southern kings mentioned if Hosea is going to be ministering to the northern kingdom? Well, that was for the benefit of Hosea's readers in the southern kingdom of Judah. We know that Hosea ministered to the northern kingdom of Israel because in Hosea 7:5 we read this, on the day of our king, he calls the king of Israel our king, the princes are sick with the heat of wine. Now, the name Hosea means salvation, great name for a prophet. He is said in verse 1 to prophesy during the reigns of those aforementioned kings that I ran out for you. This was just before the destruction of Israel in 722 B.C., because that's what he's referring to. This is when Assyria conquered the northern kingdom, whose capital was at Samaria, the capital city of the province of Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim. Tiglath-Pileser III of Assyria had come in and conquered some scattered cities in northern Israel, starting in about 732. 10 years later, Shalmaneser V came in and wiped out Samaria. He didn't finish out that year. A new Assyrian king took over in 722 and deported the northern Israelites all over the Assyrian Empire, the ancient Near East. And so Hosea is prophesying right before this happened. His whole prophetic ministry covers a long time. A commentator named Gabelin says over 70 years, so that Hosea must have been a very old man by the time he wrote this. Guzik, on the other hand, said Hosea's ministry spanned 760 B.C. to 720. Approximately, that's about 40 years. Big difference. But overall, Hosea prophesied for a long time. I've already mentioned the religious conditions of his time, but let's mention some of the politics. Nearly all the usurping kings near the end of Israel's life had made alliances with foreign powers. That resulted in the introduction of the immoral, corrupt Phoenician and Syrian idolatry. Syria, of course, was right next to northern Israel, and they were constantly making alliances with Syria. And, of course, the whole northern kingdom of Israel had begun upon a basis of golden calf idolatry. You remember Jeroboam, 931 B.C. He took the golden calf, set up an altar at Dan, and one at Bethel. So Hosea would be right at home in America. The truth was being trampled on. We go now to Hosea 1, verses 2 through 3. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, "Go, take to yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry, for the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord." So he, that's Hosea, went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. Now, Adam Clark says that this Gomer is a real person. This is not a parable. Some people say this is a vision. Some people say it's a parable. I don't hold to that. It's amazing how many conservative, well-known commentators do hold that, though. We'll talk about that right now as we talk about Gomer, and we discuss this alleged moral problem. Why would God ask a prophet to marry a prostitute? Well, quite frankly, I don't have a problem with that. But here's how the argument goes. Hey, prostitutes were supposed to be stoned according to the law. Deuteronomy 22:20-22 says this. But if this charge is true, the charge of adultery, the charge of sexual immorality, is true, that the girl was not found a virgin, then they shall bring out the girl to the doorway of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her to death, because she has committed an act of folly in Israel by playing the harlot in her father's house. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you, etc., etc., etc. All right, so that's what was supposed to happen to prostitutes, but this prostitute got to marry a prophet. So let's look at how scholars and commentators and Bible teachers have tried to reconcile this problem. Here's option number one. Though the law forbade a high priest to marry a prostitute, the law says nothing about a prophet marrying a prostitute. Leviticus 21:7 says, they, the high priest, are not to marry a woman defiled by prostitution. It might be the priest in general, not just the high priest. I think it's the priest. They are not to marry one divorced by her husband, for the priest is holy to his God. Yes, I just looked. It's priest in general, not supposed to marry prostitutes, but doesn't say anything about a prophet. So that means that Hosea is not breaking the law and God's not asking him to break a law. So that would seem to solve that problem. But here's option number two to solve the problem of a prophet marrying a prostitute. Even if that had been illegal, God overrode the law by saying it was okay. Because God can override the law, because he wrote the law, it's his law, he can do with it what he wants. Just like when God told Abraham to kill Isaac. Well, obviously, killing somebody is illegal. God told him to do it anyway. Now, of course, God stopped it from being carried out. How about when God told the Israelites to steal the Egyptians' jewels? Sounds like thievery, does it not? How about when God told Isaiah to walk around naked, thus offending public decency? Well, God often asked prophets to do difficult things. Hosea is no exception. Here's what a commentator named Pusey says. We must not imagine things to be unworthy of God because they do not commend themselves to us. God does not dispense with the moral law because the moral law has its source in the mind of God himself. To dispense with it would mean to contradict himself. But God, who is absolute Lord of all things which he made, may, at his sovereign will, dispose of the lives of things which he created. Thus, as sovereign judge, he commanded the lives of the Canaanites to be taken by Israel, as, in his ordinary providence, he has ordained that the magistrate should not bear the sword in vain, but has made him his minister, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. So again, he, whose are all things, will to repay to the Israelites their hard and just servitude by commanding them to spoil the Egyptians. He, who created marriage, commanded to Hosea whom he should marry. The prophet was not defiled by taking as his lawful wife, at God's bidding, one defiled, however a hard thing this was. Now, I agree with this. I think it was a hard thing that Hosea had to do, but it was not an immoral thing. Now, in favor of the view that Hosea actually married a prostitute, we'll see their other views later on, but in favor of this is that it parallels Israel's situation better than other views that say that she was not a prostitute when Hosea married her. Because God loved Abraham while he was a sinner, and then he took Abraham into a covenant relationship. Not after Abraham reformed himself did God then say, oh, Abraham, you're a good person, now I can marry you. Likewise, Hosea didn't probably say, oh, Gomer, you're a good person, I'm going to marry you. And then he watched her go to seed. Okay, so that's option number two. It might have been illegal, but God overrode the law by saying it was okay. I don't think it's necessary to go that far because I don't think it was illegal. But if you do think it was illegal, well, then you can say God overrode the law. Now, here's option number three. Hosea did not marry Gomer in the flesh. He married her in a vision. And you think, well, that's just a punt. That's just a cop-out. Well, Jameson Fawcett Brown and the famous Kyle of Kyle and Delitzsch fame say that that's what it was. It was a vision. But the problem with that is it looks like God is countenancing prostitution. So Hosea is telling Israel to not commit spiritual adultery, and he's committing physical adultery in a vision? Well, I would answer that by saying, look, Hosea is not committing adultery. He's marrying someone else who's committing sexual immorality of some sort, prostitution, whatever it was she was doing. But Hosea wasn't doing it. John Gill, complaining about this view that it was Hosea marrying Gomer in a vision, Gill says, how could such an impure thing be told by the Holy Spirit to a prophet of God? Gill further says, what kind of effect would relaying such a vision have to the people? They would mock him to scorn. Ah, so you just had a vision that you're going to marry a prostitute. Ho, ho, ho. I think those are pretty good objections myself. I don't believe it was a vision. Option number four. God told Hosea to marry a woman who was a reformed harlot. She used to be a harlot, but she quit being a prostitute at the time she married Hosea. Thus goes the argument. The problem with that is that Hosea ended up marrying a real live adulteress at his second marriage. So the problem still remains even if Gomer were reformed at the time that he married her the first time. We read in Hosea 3:1, "Then the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who was loved by her husband." Doesn't say it's Gomer, but I think it was. "Yet an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes." In other words, Gomer had run out on Hosea, become an adulteress, and God says, go marry her anyway. So now he is marrying, if not a prostitute, at least an adulteress. So there's the problem again. So the option that says that God is going to have his morality, if you will, preserved by not asking Hosea to marry a harlot because she was a reformed harlot. She had stopped being a harlot at the time of the marriage. That option is not going to work because in Hosea 3:1, God asked Hosea to marry a bona fide woman of sexual immorality. Also, why would Gomer's children be called children of whoredom if she were reformed? Well, this is a weak argument, I think, but let's read Hosea 1 verse 2. "When the Lord first spoke to Hosea, he said this to him, go and marry a promiscuous wife and have children of promiscuity." Now, it sounds like having children of promiscuity means that Hosea had children of lovers outside of her marriage to Hosea. Could be. However, those children could be Hosea's. They could be called children of promiscuity because their mother was a reformed whore. In which case, the option that says that Gomer was a reformed whore at the time of her marriage to Hosea could still stand if you say the children of promiscuity are born after her marriage to Hosea. Hosea 2:4 says, "I will have no compassion on her children because they are the children of promiscuity." Again, those children could be the children of adulterers who cuckolded Hosea during his marriage, but she could have been straight. She could have been a reformed whore, maybe not even a whore at all when she married Hosea the first time. I don't like this option that she was a reformed whore and so she was pure when she married Hosea, because a reformed prostitute is not as good a symbol for Israel as a working prostitute, a current prostitute. Israel was continually and continuing to be a spiritual whore. It's not like Israel was pure and holy and all of a sudden started becoming a whore. I guess you could say that at the Exodus. Israel was pure. I even have trouble saying that. They complained about God so much that they were a mess from the get-go. And I think that Gomer was a mess from the get-go too. Next option, number five. The story is a parable. It's not really true. It's just a story. John Gill suggests that. I don't believe that. It doesn't sound like a parable. Gomer, the son of Diblaim, that sounds like a real woman. Now, here's option number six from a commentator named Gabelin. He says that Gomer became unchaste only after the marriage. In other words, she wasn't a reformed prostitute. She wasn't ever a prostitute before she got married, and then she married Hosea, and then she started catting out on him. So the wife of harlotry, that title is spoken in anticipation of what was going to happen. Well, you see all the options, and I don't know what the option is, and I really don't think it matters, because the point is that Israel was committing spiritual adultery against God, and God was using Hosea's marriage as a fantastic object lesson. So we don't want to get into the weeds about exactly what condition Gomer was in when she married Hosea. And we certainly don't want to think that God did something untoward. Oh, how could God do this? That just doesn't bother me at all. Now in verse 3, Gomer conceives and bears Hosea a son. Now, if you think about it, that son could have been Hosea's, and I tend to think it was, but it could have been one of Gomer's paramours, one of Gomer's lovers. And that's the trouble about marrying a promiscuous woman. You don't ever know whether that baby's yours or not. We go now to Hosea 1, verses 4 through 5. "And the Lord said to Hosea, name him Jezreel," the son that was just born. "Name him Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will punish the house of Jehu," who ruled from 841 to 814. for the bloodshed of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it will come about on that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Now the little boy's name was Jezreel. The Hebrew means God will disperse, sow, or scatter. So we'll just think scatter. So his name was scattered. Now what does this mean? When was Israel scattered? Well, it could be the house of Jehu was scattered. The house of Jehu, four kings later, went down unto Shalem in 752 when Shalem assassinated the last king of Jehu's dynasty, a king named Zechariah. But that's not what it is, I'm sure, because it says, God says in verse 4, I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. So that's the end of the whole northern kingdom that's being talked about here. So that's who's being scattered. Northern Israel is being scattered, and thus the name Jezreel. Now verse 4 says, God says, I will punish the house of Jehu. Who's the house of Jehu? Well, those are the kings in Jehu's dynasty. Jehu ruled from 841 to 814, then Jehoahaz from 814 to 798, then Jehoash 798 to 782, Jeroboam II 782 to 753, then Zechariah 753 to 752, and then Zechariah got assassinated in 752. By Shalem, who only ruled for 6 months, and that was the end of Jehu's dynasty. Now, we can read verse 4 and say that Shalem is a punishment for the dynasty of Jehu, because verse 4 says, I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed of Jezreel. Sounds like Jehu's being punished, doesn't it? Well, before we get into that issue, let's talk about what the bloodshed of Jezreel was. This is not difficult. There's only one possible reference that this could refer to. According to Peter Goman of the Shepherd Seminary, that passage would be 2 Kings 9, verses 24 through 10:17. I'm not going to read it all to you, of course, but in that passage we see Jehu shedding an awful lot of blood in the Valley of Jezreel. The Valley of Jezreel, by the way, ran from the Mediterranean Sea between Acre and Haifa. Haifa is at the very northwestern corner of Israel. Acre is in southern Lebanon. And the Valley of Jezreel is flat and runs down southeast from there until it hits the Jordan River, south of the Sea of Galilee. That's the Valley of Jezreel. Famous place in that, on the edge of the Valley of Jezreel, about halfway down, is Megiddo, the famous place of Megiddo. There's some other places. Gideon fought in there, the Spring of Herod. Lots of things happened. The Witch of Endor is in there, but there were also a lot of battles in Jezreel too, and Jehu was responsible for a lot of said battles, a lot of bloodshed. He killed his predecessor Joram, who ruled from 852 to 841 when Jehu took over and killed him. Jehu also famously killed Jezebel, threw her down out of the window. The dogs ate her. Jehu also killed the southern king of Judah, Ahaziah, near the Valley of Jezreel. Jehu killed Ahab's 70 sons, who might have taken over. Ahab ruled earlier from 874 to 853. Actually, the 70 sons' heads were brought from Samaria to Jezreel, but it's still the same idea. Blood is being shed in Jezreel. Jehu did an awful lot of killing in the Valley of Jezreel. And so you might think as you read verse 4, God's going to punish the house of Jehu for all that bloodshed. There's one little problem with that, though. 2 Kings 10:30 says this, Nevertheless, the Lord said to Jehu, Because you have done well in carrying out what is right in my sight, and have done to the house of Ahab all that was in my heart, four generations of your sons will sit on the throne of Israel. God praises Jehu for what he did. So we have a problem here. Now there are three options as to whether Jehu behaved justly or unjustly. Option number one, we could say that he behaved unjustly. And in favor of that option, we could just read verse 4 of our text in Hosea 1. I will punish the house of Jehu. You punish somebody for doing something unjustly. But of course, then you still have the problem of how do you handle 2 Kings 10:30, which I just read, which said that God tells Jehu, you have done well in wiping out the house of Ahab. How do you reconcile those two verses and say that Jehu acted justly? Well, Dr. Goman of the Shepherd Seminary says that the answer is that the punishment is to come on the successors of Jehu for their iniquity, not Jehu's iniquity. In other words, Jehu didn't do anything wrong. His successors did. And Goman quotes the Holman Christian Study Bible here to prove his point. Then the Lord said to him, Name him Jezreel, for in a little while I will bring the bloodshed of Jezreel on the house of Jehu. In other words, all that blood that was shed in the Valley of Jezreel, it's going to be shed on the house of Jehu, on the dynasty. I'm not going to punish Jehu. I'm going to punish the house of Jehu. The Home and Christian Study Bible backs that up perfectly, actually. Whereas the New American Standard, which I had read from originally, says, I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed. It says the same thing, but it just a little bit different emphasis. It's the punishing of the house of Jehu sounds like it's a punishment that springs from what Jehu did. But no, it's the house of Jehu that's punished, not Jehu himself. Well, that's the easiest way to reconcile 2 Kings 10 and Hosea 1:4. There's a third way you could reconcile it, or a third option as to whether Jehu behaved justly or unjustly. We could say that Jehu behaved justly with an impure motive. As Gill says, God sometimes punishes the instruments he makes use of in doing his work. They either overdo it, exercising too much cruelty and not doing it upon right principles and with right views, as the kings of Assyria and Babylon in their famous invasions of Israel. So that could be it. God says, I'm happy with you, Ahab. You did a good thing, even though your motives are impure. Barnes says this, yet Jehu shed this blood, the blood of the house of Ahab, of Joram and Jezebel and the 70 sons of Ahab, at God's command and in fulfillment of his will. How was it then sin? Because if we do what is the will of God for any end of our own, for anything except God, we do, in fact, our own will and not God's. So that's how Barnes handles it. He says, the justice was done, but it was done with the wrong motive. So that's why he's going to be punished by losing his dynasty after four more generations. I like Goldman's solution the better. I believe that Jehu did what God told him to do, and then God wipes out his descendants because they're committing the same sort of bloodshed that happened in the Valley of Jezreel, perpetrated by their ancestor Jehu. We go to verse 5. God says, it will come about on that day that I will break the bow of Israel. The bow, of course, is a bow as in bow and arrow, a military weapon. It's a symbol of military strength. And so God's going to break the military strength of Israel. Where? In the Valley of Jezreel. Now, there's a problem here, knowing when this was fulfilled. Now, you could say, and I don't say this, but you could say that this is referring to breaking the power of northern Israel, more particularly the power of Jehu's dynasty, which ended when Zechariah was assassinated by Shalom in 752. And then Adam Clark says that could have happened somewhere in the Valley of Jezreel. Could have, but we don't have any evidence of it. That, of course, assumes that the reference is to the end of the house of Jehu, not the end of the house of Israel. And I don't think that's true. This is talking about the end of the house of Israel, because that's what Hosea says. In verse 4, I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. That's the whole nation of Israel, not just the house of Jehu. So we're going to wipe that out as an option that is referring to the death of Zechariah, the last of Jehu's dynasty that died in the Valley of Jezreel at some unknown place. All right, here's option number 2. This is from Adam Clark. The prophecy is fulfilled by some signal defeat of the Israelites by the Assyrians in the Valley of Jezreel. Of course, the northern kingdom went down in 722 under the ministrations of Shalmaneser V of Assyria, but there's no record of him doing anything in the Valley of Jezreel in 722 to carry it out, so Clark just speculates, well, it must have happened there somewhere. That's not very satisfying. Option number 3, Barnes says, Shalmaneser V did have a battle near a place called Beth Arbel, which he assumes is in the Valley of Jezreel. We read in Hosea 10, verses 14 through 15, the roar of battle will rise against your people, and all your fortifications will be demolished in a day of war, like Shalman's destruction of Beth Arbel. Shalman sounds like Shalmaneser V. Destructions of Beth Arbel. Mothers will be dashed to pieces along with their children, so it will be done to you, Bethel, because of your extreme evil. At dawn, the king of Israel will be totally destroyed. Now, that sounds pretty good, except there's one little problem. BibleAtlas.org does not have Beth Arbel in the Jezreel Valley. Has it near Ramoth Gilead, way down about 40 miles east of Jerusalem in the Transjordan area? That's not anywhere near the Valley of Jezreel. And in fact, the commentator Joseph Benson says, of any such battle, we have no mention in history, sacred or profane, a battle with Shalmaneser. We have no mention of it in history, sacred or profane. Now, we'll get to Hosea 10 when we get there, and I'll talk about it some more then, but I'm not so sure that Barnes has got the answer there, that this was fulfilled at a battle at Beth Arbel in the Valley of Jezreel. So we go to option number four. We know that Tiglath-Pileser III of Assyria took several principal cities in the plain of Jezreel during the reign of Pekah. Pekah ruled between 740 and 732. Later, during Hoshea's reign, Hoshea ruled from 732 to 722. Samaria was taken by Shalmaneser V in 722. So the end result of all that was the breaking of the bow of Israel. So if you just start earlier, going back to the time that Tiglath-Pileser III took principal cities in the plain of Jezreel, then we can see the prophecy of Hosea in verse 5 of chapter 1 fulfilled. It will come about on that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. The breaking of the bow started when Tiglath-Pileser III showed up in the valley of Jezreel. We go now to Hosea chapter 1 verses 6 through 7. Then she conceived again, that's Gomer, and gave birth to a daughter. And the Lord said to Hosea, name her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel, that I should ever forgive them. But I will have compassion on the house of Judah, and deliver them by the Lord their God. And I will not deliver them by bow, sword, battle, horses, or horsemen. Now Lo-Ruhamah means she has not obtained compassion. This verse is quoted in 1 Peter 2:10, once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. That last part of 1 Peter 2:10, you had not received mercy, you have not received compassion. That's what Lo-Ruhamah means. Now think about it. If you had this name, if you were a little girl, having a name like that, talk about being rejected. And for an apologetics question, how do you handle that? Why would God put a name like that on a little kid and have her bear the scorn of all of her peers? That is a question, my friends, I cannot answer. Now, going back to the prophetic significance of that, God says, I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel, that I should ever forgive them. The NASB has it. What that means is, I'm not going to forgive them until the time that they're destroyed by the Assyrians in 722. The King James, instead of saying that I should ever forgive them, the King James says, but I will utterly take them away. Hosea 1:6 in the Holman Christian Study Bible says the same thing. I will certainly take them away. So it's a translation issue. The point is they're going down and there's not going to be any mercy. And the name of the kid is No Mercy. Verse 7, but, there's a contrast here, but I will have compassion on the house of Judah. And remember, Hosea is preaching against the house of Israel, northern Israel that went down in 722. Southern Israel, Judah, did not go down to 586 to the Babylonians after the Assyrians were gone. And God says in verse 7, but I will have compassion on the house of Judah and deliver them by the Lord their God, and not to deliver them by bow, sword, battle, horses, or horsemen. This refers to 2 Kings 19:35, about 21 years or so after northern Israel went down to the Assyrians in 722, and in 701, Assyria was giving Hezekiah a hard time. Hezekiah's holed up in Jerusalem, if you recall the story. And we read in 2 Kings 19:35, that night the angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. When the people got up the next morning, there were all the dead bodies. Notice how Hosea had predicted that Judah would be delivered not by bow, sword, battle, horses, or horsemen. In other words, not by military means. Judah was delivered by a plague of some sort. We go now to Hosea 1, verses 8 through 10. When she, that's Gomer, had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and gave birth to a son. Gomer conceived. So she's had a son, Jezreel, a daughter, Lo-Ruhamah, and now she has a third child who's a son. And the Lord said, name him Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, and I'm not your God. Lo-Ami means not my people. Yet the number of the sons of Israel will be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And in the place where it is said to them, you are not my people, Lo-Ami, it will be said to them, you are the sons of the living God. Now, this passage here in Hosea is quoted by the Apostle Paul in Romans 9, verses 24 through 26. Paul says, on us, the ones he also called, not only from the Jews, but also from the Gentiles. As he also says in Hosea, I will call not my people, that's Lo-Ami, my people, and she who is unloved, beloved, that's Lo-Ruhamah, that's Lo-Ruhamah. And it will be in the place where they were told, you are not my people, that they will be called sons of the living God. So there Paul predicts the arrival of the Christian church. The Jews are not God's people. The Gentiles are not God's people. Now they all are God's people. Because he says in verse 24, the ones that God called not only from the Jews, but also from the Gentiles. They will be sons of the living God. They will be God's people. And of course, the reason they're not God's people, lo ami, is because they've sinned so much and God's going to wipe them out with the Assyrians. However, that's the bad news. The good news comes in verse 10. Yet the number of the sons of Israel will be like the sand of the sea. Isn't that great? You're not going to be my people. You're wiped out. You're finished. However, there's some good news coming because I made a covenant with Abraham. Israel will be like the sand of the sea. And of course, that happened in the New Testament, as Paul says in Romans 9, verses 24 through 26, which I just quoted. The Jews and the Gentiles who believe in Jesus will be called sons of the living God. And then Israel will be like the sand of the sea, just like God promised Abraham. I didn't pull out all of the sand verses, but here's one, Genesis 32:12, for you, that Yahweh said, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered. Now, I've told you how it was fulfilled, but let's look at three options on how this verse 10 might be fulfilled. Option number one, it could refer to the Israelites after their conversion to Christianity. In other words, just the Jewish Christians. You Jewish Christians will be my people, but I don't think so, because Paul said in Romans 9:24, Jews, Gentiles, all sons of the living God. That's option number two. The Gentiles are converted to God and they become the true Israel, along with the Jews, both Jews and Gentiles. That's Adam Clark's view. Also, we have Peter quoting this verse, and he fulfills it in the church. 1 Peter 2:10, once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you were lo ami, but now you are ami, God's people. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. In other words, you are no longer lo ruhamah. Lo means not in Hebrew. Now you've got mercy. Another option that's been suggested is there will be is the sand of the sea when they return from Babylon. I don't think so. They weren't as the numbers as the sand of the sea. That can't be it. Chapter 1 is going to finish off with a bunch of messianic expectation on the part of the prophet Hosea. We read in verse 11, and the Judeans and the Israelites will be gathered together. They will appoint for themselves a single ruler and go up from the land, for the day of Jezreel will be great. Now, this verse is a little enigmatic at first glance, but fortunately, all the commentators agree on how to interpret it. The Judeans and the Israelites will be gathered together. Options as to when that might be. First of all, when the Assyrian exiles, the exiles to Assyria in 722, and the exiles to Babylon in 589, they become united. That's when they are gathered together. When did that happen? Well, after Cyrus the Great's decree of 539, Cyrus the Persian, when he conquered Babylon in 539, he issued a decree and said, Jews, you can go back to Jerusalem. Well, how did the 722 exiles to Assyria from the northern kingdom, how did they get joined with the 589 exiles coming back from Babylonia? Well, here are a couple of options as to how that might have happened. This is from Poole. Jews from the northern kingdom of Israel had migrated to Judah and thus were taken captive in 586 when the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem and took the captives to Babylon. And so some northern Jews were mixed in with the southern Jews. Also, some of the Assyrian exiles to Assyria from the northern kingdom of Israel, they had been translated to Babylon by Assyria. Remember, Assyria back then in 722 controlled Mesopotamia, controlled Babylon. And so, surely, some of the exiles would have ended up in Babylon. And so, physically, the exiles from the northern kingdom of Israel and the exiles from the southern kingdom, Judah, were united in returning back to the land. And so that's how they're gathered together. That's option number one. Here's option number two. This gathering together of Judeans, southern Israelites, and the Israelites, the northern Israelites, are Jews from northern Israel and Jews from Judah uniting in the Christian church in the New Covenant era. This is Barnes and Benson's view. Poole says that option one, the physical exiles from northern Israel and southern Israel, Judah, coming together and uniting is a type of them coming together in the church in the New Covenant era. And I prefer that option. Now notice the Judeans and the Israelites will be gathered together. Gather is the opposite of scatter, which Jezreel means. Jezreel has other meanings too, as we'll see in a minute. But remember the first child of Gomer was Jezreel, a prophetic object lesson which says, Israel, you're going to be scattered in 722 BC. But now, the opposite of the scattering is going to take place, because we're in the good part of the prophecy. The bad news came first, and now God says, despite all the punishment I'm going to wreak upon your heads, I'm going to keep my covenant promise, and I'm going to gather Judeans and Israelites. Next, in verse 11, they, the Judeans and Israelites, will appoint for themselves a single ruler. What's the options? What are the options for this single ruler? Option number one, Zerubbabel, who led the Israelites back from Babylon in 538 after the decree of Cyrus in 539. Barnes says it's Zerubbabel, but Barnes also says it's Christ. And so do the other commentators, Benson and Pulpit. The single ruler of the Jews and the Israelites will be Christ, who rules over converted southern Jews and northern Jews. Poole says that what you've got here is a type, Zerubbabel, who is the single ruler over the combined exiles coming back to the land. That Zerubbabel is a type of Christ. And I like that too. I like the history being a type of the church. Now, these united Judeans and Israelites will go up from the land. Remember, land is can be translated as earth. The land is either Babylon. Barnes says it's primarily Babylon. Poole says it's Babylon. So the exiles will come back from Babylon. Barnes and Benson say that it could be the earth. Benson says it's the whole aggregate of lands that Babylon represents. In other words, the earth. Because remember, the exiles were scattered all over the place in the ancient Near East, not just Babylon. So they come back either from Babylon or from the ancient Near Eastern earth, and they go back to Jerusalem. Again, but all that's a type of the coming into the church, as we've mentioned over and over again when we went through Isaiah and Jeremiah, and Ezekiel too, for that matter. Hosea finishes off chapter 1 with this statement, for the day of Jezreel will be great. Well, what is the day of Jezreel? Jezreel can mean to scatter, but it also can mean to sow, because when you sow seeds, you scatter the seeds. And so the day of Jezreel is the day of sowing, namely the sowing of seeds in the Christian church. Barnes, Benson, and Poole all say that. Out of the mouths of three witnesses shall every truth be established. The day of Jezreel will be great. Again, this is a messianic prophecy looking forward to the day of the church. And on that happy note, ladies and gentlemen, we're finished with Hosea chapter 1. We're ready to go in our next audio to Hosea chapter 2, which I will entitle Israel's unfaithfulness is punished. Hope to see you then. Hope you enjoyed this audio.